This is John Dewthany, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of October 2011. John Dewthany, Part 1.
Right, my name is John Richard Dewthany. I was born in Tatsfield in Kent, 7th of March 1945.
You were about to tell me a story a moment ago and I stopped you till we turned the microphones on.
Oh yeah, one of the more incongruous moments of my life was when in 1996... I was at a field camp at a place called A81, that was the only name it had, 500 miles inland up on the Dronning Moorland ice cap. We were at 8,500 feet, and basically sitting on 8,500 feet of ice. And I remember this moment that I was lying in the tent, temperature outside probably about minus 15 to minus 20, with a continuous wind blowing. So lying here with the tent just here in my sleeping bag, with the wind whistling past. And we were listening to my shortwave radio. And on that shortwave radio was Sorry I Haven't a Clue. And I just thought, this is the silliest place in the world to be lying and listening to an extremely silly programme. You know, it's just one of those odd moments. And that actually figured on the radio programme that I was talking about because it was being recorded at the time.
But, so what radio programme was this, John?
It was a radio diary for BBC 4, which wanted to track just somebody in Antarctica, what they got up to, and compare it, I think, with somebody who was on a tourist ship. And so we were really way out in the middle of nowhere, air-supported, building some scientific equipment. There was some four of us. And so, you know, we had some lovely little moments. My wife would always pack me a Christmas box when I went to the Antarctic. And in it that year was a lovely little piece of Christmas cake. And so we had a work tent where we would meet to, you know, have a smoker and so on. And I would slice up the piece of Christmas cake. So there was four little pieces each for us, you know, and that was set against somebody on a tour ship is tucking into a five-course meal. So, you know, it was just various incongruous moments, really.
Can you recall what year that was?
Well, it would have been 1996 that I was in the field, so it would have been that year. I may have a recording of it somewhere, I don't know, but I think it would have gone out in that year of 1996.
Can you remember how you got the material back to the UK, the recordings?
They were in digital cassettes. It was one of the first Sony digital recorders that they gave me to use, and I just brought them back with me.
Oh, you brought them back?
Oh, yeah, and then the programme was made later, post hoc. Yeah.
Tell me a bit about your childhood. What were your parents up to?
Ah, my childhood was a bit of a strange childhood. My parents parted company with each other when I was 11, and I lived with my mother. My father, I didn't really have much to do with thereafter. He was a civil servant. My mother was then had to try and make a living to keep us afloat, myself and my brother. My sister had already left home then. So I had quite a, in retrospect, quite a poverty-stricken childhood from the age of 11. I failed my 11 plus, which was probably not surprising, given the circumstances. Mm. And we were living in a one-room bedsit for quite a while, and generally pretty horrible. Although at the age that I was, I didn't really recognise it quite so much as that, I suppose. And we didn't have television or anything like that. So the library became my great saving grace, and I went to what was known as a secondary modern school. It was called colloquially Drayton Drainhole because it wasn't a place of high academic standards. And I, you know, if I had not suddenly realised that I was good at maths, in fact, not only was I good at maths, but I was better than anybody else in the school at maths, and a teacher recognised that as well, I probably wouldn't have followed the path that I did.
Do you want to name the teacher for posterity?
Sadly, I can't remember his name. I'd love to, but I can't. I wish I could, because he was very important in that. In that he he gave me my head, and the headmaster, whose name I think was Mr. Walters, also gave me my head. And I managed to take 6 O levels at this school and pass them. Actually, I took 7 and failed one, but that's another story. And so I had passed maths, physics, and applied maths. Never been done at this school before. And I had to teach myself applied maths because there wasn't a teacher that could do it. So I was allowed to do that instead of playing football, which I didn't enjoy anyway. And then after I finished at that school, I went to a technical college to take my A-levels, took 3 A-levels. But, of course, coming from such a strange background, and in that time, which was in the 1960s, I didn't have the qualifications to go to a university because I didn't have languages or anything like that. And so I ended up going to what was then called the Regent Street Polytechnic in London. It's now, I think, Central London University or something like that, where they did accept me to read an external London University degree in physics. Which I did, and managed to get a first-class honours degree out of it, which you could have knocked me down with a feather when that happened. And that really was my childhood. It was a childhood which was really rather solitary, very bookish, and it wasn't until fairly late in my teenage years that I discovered table tennis, which was the only sport I took part in because I was left-handed, and therefore didn't really get encouraged to do sports at school, except right-handed in those days. And then subsequently I discovered squash, and so I used to play table tennis and squash. But I wasn't really a very gregarious person.
Well, mathematics in your genetic makeup somewhere.
That is interesting. Yes. I don't know whether you've heard of a person by the name of Henry Dudeney.
I haven't.
Henry Dudeney is a distant relative, but from the same family. He was a Victorian mathematician and was famous for writing books of mathematical puzzles, which I think are still some of them available today. So I suppose you could say that there was some math somewhere in the background.
And the decision to study physics at university, where did that come from?
Having discovered I was good at maths, I also discovered I was good at working things out, and I enjoyed physics. In fact, I was such a nerd that I would used to go to the cinema and sit there in the interval working out things like why a body fell in free fall around the earth, you know, because that interested me at the time. And because I really was quite a quiet and, I would have thought, very withdrawn little individual at the time.
I presume that's somewhat changed these days, is it?
Well, that's part of the story, really.
The FID story?
Yes, it is, actually. Yes, it is. It's quite, so, for me, quite an important part of the FID story.
Well, let's deal with that now. In what way, this is often a question I ask, in what way did your Antarctic experiences change you as a person?
Oh, fundamentally. Fundamentally, first of all, even considering going to the Antarctic was something which was completely out of character if you'd known me as the character I was in the age of 20. Why I did it is a little bit lost in time, but the fact that I did was really rather serendipitous because I had been given what then I think was a rather prestigious opportunity to do a PhD at Imperial College in the then very sexy subject of fusion physics. And one May morning, I walked into Regent Street Polytechnic in 1966, and I had a bit of a thing for the welfare officer's secretary. So I used to like to lurk in and talk to him while I ogled her. She was a very nice lady, and she was really quite kind in letting me do this. So I walked into that office, and for some reason that I cannot remember now, perhaps there was a programme on television, or I don't know, or the radio or something about Antarctica, but I walked in there and I turned to the welfare officer. His name was Martin Atkinson. And so they wanted to go to the Antarctic. And I think it was to impress the young lady, you see. Anyway, he was an ex-military chaplain. And so he looked at me rather sternly and he said, there's a telephone book, look under Antarctic. And so I did. And there wasn't anything. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I've demonstrated I'm a hero here. And he said, well, look under British then. And so I looked under British. There was the British Antarctic Survey. I phoned them up. And I said, have you got any jobs for physicists? And they said, no. And I said, well, have you got any jobs that are technical? And they said, yeah, we've got a job called an ionospheric technician. And so under the beady eye of the young lady, I said, oh, I'll come and be interviewed for that then.
And did you actually know what ionospherics were?
Only in a general sense, because it's, you know, I was a physicist and I knew that there was a layer called the ionosphere, and therefore I knew that, were, that it was of some interest. And I went for this interview, again, really not expecting anybody would give me a job, because to my own personal view of myself was that I was a rather slightly built, rather withdrawn, quiet physicist who had really no other interests. I went to the interview and I met three people who became very, very critical to my life, really. One was Sir Vivian Fuchs. Second was Bill Sloman, who was the administrative officer at Bass at the time. And the third was a guy called Roy Piggott. And Roy and Bill were the ones that interviewed me. And during the interview, Sir Vivian just wandered into the room. He had an adjoining office in Gillingham Street and just sank into this rather overstuffed leather armchair next to me with his pipe in his hand, looking at me over his eyebrows, you know, just looking at me, really. He didn't say anything. And I had this interview, and I obviously managed to impressed sufficiently, I think. But Piggott was a wonderful character. You may have come across his name elsewhere. He was a lovely man, a real eccentric, amazingly eccentric. He had this habit of doing what we call piggoting. And if you got piggoted, it would be him lecturing you on some aspect of probably the ionosphere, but could be anything. It could go on for hours. And he would suddenly recognise that it was either time for you to go home or something like that. And he would stop in mid-sentence, apologise, let you go home. And then you'd come back the next day and he'd start where he left off. You know, he was a lovely man. Anyway, he obviously saw what he liked, what he saw. And he said that rather than employ me as an ionospheric technician, he'd like to employ me as an ionospheric physicist with the possibility of doing some research. And so that's how I got the job. I remember that Bill, the only question I remember him asking me was whether I could fix a watch if it broke. And I did actually have to fix one, but I told him no at the time.
Piggott became your head of upper atmospheric sciences at some point in your career.
Yes, he did. But to start with, he worked at the Radio and Space Research Station. He didn't work for Bass, but the ionospherics program that Bass operated was done essentially for him and for the Radio and Space Research Station. So when I had taken the job, I then went to the Radio and Space Research Station, which is near Slough. I went there in July 1966, I think, for my training under Roy. And that largely consisted of being left on your own to read stuff up, but occasionally getting a thoroughly good piggoting, and then having lots of bullshit thrown at me by the FIDs that had just come back and that were, you know, writing up or whatever. And in particular, I suppose a mega FID, I suppose, would be Bill Bell Chambers, who you may have also come across.
I'm seeing him in December.
Yeah, well, he was based there, but actually working as a member of the staff at RSRS. And so I spent a happy few months coming to love and hate is this Mark II Union Radio Ionoson, otherwise known as the Beastie.
And was Piggott responsible for that machine?
Well, he was responsible for it in the sense that the program that was being run at our stations in Antarctica with those machines was his, he was deeply involved in the research that led to those machines being designed. He wasn't directly behind the particular Union Radio Mark II, as far as I'm aware.
How did you take to ionospheric physics, and in particular, how did you take to the Beastie?
Well, the Beastie was a wonderful piece of early automation which ran on bicycle chains and bloody great big valves and cams and goodness knows what. It worked very well. It needed a lot of care and attention to run it, and the physics behind it all was very interesting. And so I took to ionospheric physics, I must say. It wasn't, and in a sense, it was something similar to what I was going to do anyway, because fusion research is all about very hot plasmas. The ionosphere is all about a natural plasma. And so there was, you know, there was a connection there, I suppose. So I found it quite interesting. But it was subsequent events in Antarctica that really shaped my worldview, and actually directed me away, really, from just a career in science.
Do you want to elaborate on that now?
Well, I mean, it comes out as we go along, but when I got back from my first 2 years in Antarctica, I had changed very considerably. I mean, you may talk to a guy called Al Smith. Well, at my retirement do, Al came up to me because we'd sailed down to the Antarctica together on the John Biscoe, and he had subsequently come to Argentine Islands when I was the base commander. And he said to me, he said, "Well, John, when I met you on the ship, you were a boy, and when I met you on the station, you were a man."
Fuchs says something similar, doesn't he, in Ice and Men? He described you being, yes. I forget the exact phraseology now, but it rather an idealistic academic on the way down and
yes.
Some rather different kind of kettle of fish on the way back.
Yes, he said some very kind things about me in Ice and Men, and I thank him for them. But
so what changed you?
What changed me? What changed me was several things. First of all, when I got on base, for the first few weeks and months, I found it very difficult.
This is base F, isn't it?
Yes. It would have been the same anywhere, though. And that was because here was I, straight out of university, first-class honours degree. I also was awarded a medal by the college for being the best physics student and stuff like that. So I thought I was the bee's knees, you know.
Right.
You get on base, and you very quickly realise that you've got to work as part of a team, and that actually you're not an important part of the team. The important parts of the team are the people who keep the lights on and make certain the air letters arrive and put food on the table. And so that was a real one of these moments of awakening on the road to Damascus sort of thing, that I had got to find a way of working as a team member, which I'd never done before, and contribute as a team member. And you know, not think that just because I'm a physicist, I'm bloody good, because I'm not, you know. And that took a while for me to come to terms with.
Was that painful?
Well, it was painful. And actually, I was reading my the diary. I kept a diary through that first winter. Didn't in the second one for a variety of reasons, but in the first winter I did. And reading it is really quite revealing, because it's all very hypercritical self-analysis about, you know, how I needed to do better sort of thing. And so that was a big lesson to me. And then an even more surprising lesson to me was when, just towards the end of November of that year, 67, beginning of December, the then base commander, we call him Speedy, came strolling into my lab, and he said to me, "They want you to be base commander next year." And here was I was 22, just coming up 23, had no experience of life at all except for that winter. And yet these guys, Sir Vivian Fuchs, Bill Sloman, saw me as base commander material. And that I spent quite a while, because, you know, I just had no possible inkling that was coming. It just didn't seem to me that I was base commander material. And so I spent quite a while mulling over it, whether I'd do it or not. And finally decided that, you know, I'd kill myself if I didn't. You know, I'd never forgive myself for not taking the opportunity. And that, again, was a very, very formative experience to find yourself at that age in charge of a station in Antarctica, which then was probably isolated for 9 months of the year, where the only contact was HF radio, CW Morse and teleprinter, where the attitude then from what was then London office was very much more hands-off. You were expected just to get on with it. You know? It was a real major experience for me, life-forming experience, to do it, and I suppose to do it successfully, at least not to make a complete pig's ear of it anyway. And so when I came back from the Antarctic in 1969, I had a very different outlook on life. I still went into science and I still did research, but my heart wasn't in it in quite the way it would have been, I think. And I was much more interested in the broader issues of Antarctica.
Then. Let's just backtrack slightly then to this interview that you did in 2 years previously.
Yeah.
It's surprising. Have you ever wondered why they actually picked you? Because
I have.
People like you would probably get filtered out, wouldn't they? Probably?
Yeah, I don't know.
If not at the interview, then certainly on the way down on the boat.
I think, first of all, they needed somebody.
It was the job.
They needed somebody for the job.
Hmm.
Secondly, perhaps I came over better than I thought I did. And perhaps I did at the time have more self-drive and self-determination. I must have done to have achieved what I did do, given the background of my teenage years. So perhaps I radiated more a sense of presence than I really understood myself.
And Sloman had a reputation for being able to spot one, didn't he?
Bill was very good at spotting both the winners and the losers. Yes, yeah. He was. Very, very good indeed. And I suppose, again, on the ship down, and also actually through that first winter, I made a point of always being in the group that stepped forward because I felt that was important. So if ever there was a job that needed doing or, you know, a call for volunteers, then I would try and make certain I was part of that.
What are your memories of that first winter then? What sort of stands out in your memory in your diaries about the escapades or the trials and tribulations of that first winter?
Well, the wonder of the scenery to start with. Having the Huskies and learning to work in a team as a group and the incredible strength that a group has, particularly a storming group, one that's really working well together. I mean, there were characters that I didn't get on with, and there always are, of course, because you don't choose your companions. But I always tried to say to myself, well, hang on, is it me that's causing the problem here? I mean, the guy that I wintered with, who was my colleague as an atmospheric, was a guy called Chris Jeffries, who had already done a winter at Halley and was older than I was. And so we had some rough edges we had to rub off each other because, you know, I was nominally in charge of the programme and I wanted to develop it. I was supposed to be developing it and doing science rather than just running the basic programme. And so that was a difficult time as well, coming to a working relationship.
An accommodation.
An accommodation with somebody who... back in the United Kingdom, I would not have seen as a friend. I know you probably would say the same thing. I don't know.
Was the work interesting? Were you making unusual or?
No, it wasn't interesting in the sense that we were making amazing discoveries every day, because that's not the nature of the work. The nature of the work is that you need to build up long data sets. You need data sets from more than one location. You need to bring that together with other types of data, like magnetic data and so on. And so, in fact, the research that I did, which led to a PhD ultimately, wasn't done until I got home. There was effectively no research as such in the Antarctic.
Did you get out much on trips?
Well, we were unfortunate because the previous couple of years, where the staffing levels had been quite generous, they'd got out all over the place, you know, on winter field trips. My first year, the staff numbers were cut down, and so the opportunities for getting out overnight disappeared, actually. We didn't have any winter field trips in that sense of overnight ones. But we would get out for days out with the dogs and go out across to the mainland, across the sea ice and things like that. And one of the things I remember from that first winter would be also learning to ski and the wonders of chopping seal meat for dog food and stuff like that.
And when, when you'd absorbed the idea of being base commander for the second season, did you develop a particular approach to the job? Did you?
Well, I thought I did. I thought I did. I mean, there were several things I remember doing. First one was I decided that I had to be slightly apart from the rest of the base members, because it's a job where, you know, everybody's equal, but somebody's got to carry the can, and you don't have any sanctions to force people to do things. In fact, you can't force anybody to do anything. And so I decided, yeah, I had to keep myself slightly separate. There had to be a bit of distance. And as part of that, I decided I would severely limit the amount of alcohol that I consumed, wouldn't allow myself to get drunk, sort of on duty. If you'd asked me, and in fact, afterwards, when I got home, if you'd asked me what style of manager I was, or leader, I would have said I was a consensus leader. Absolute bollocks. Although I didn't recognise at the time, wasn't very good at seeing myself as others saw me. And I subsequently found some years later when I went to one of these interesting management courses, you know, which is one of these fairly touchy ones where there's no structure and you all get filmed and you all have to look at the videos of yourself. I went to this thing and we had some funny task. And I watched myself telling people what to do. You do that, you do this, you do the other. And senior people, more senior people than me in NERC at the time, just going off and doing it. and I realised that whether I was telling them the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, they were prepared to do what I told them to do. And so I realised that actually I was much less of a consensual type of leader than I thought I was. I was much more telling people what to do.
But they did it.
But they did it. And in that regard, I suppose in my second year, I was extremely lucky because of the problems that we had.
Well, I was going to say, that smacks of natural leadership qualities, doesn't it? You needn't answer that one.
Well, yes, I suppose. I shouldn't have false modesty, really, in these things. I suppose I do have natural leadership qualities, but they were rather subsumed by this natural reticence and so on that came from my childhood, I think.
So were you aware at the time of having to break the shackles from your childhood to become a leader of men?
I think I was, and I can remember in March 1968, I've actually got a photograph that I took at the time of the John Biscoe steaming away, and it's a rather grey day, and there's light pack ice covering the sea outside the station, and the ship is just heading north through the pack ice. Standing there and thinking to myself, bloody hell, it's all up to me now, you know. It's all my responsibility. And feeling the weight of that, I must say.
Were you worried, frightened, apprehensive?
I must have been apprehensive. I can't actually remember being apprehensive, but I can remember that moment of realisation that you've got to step up to the plate now. Mm. Yeah. Because I was nearly the youngest on base, actually. I'm actually younger than Brian, Brian Gardner.
You alluded to the problems of that second winter, which you had to deal with as base commander. And are you willing to talk about Ken Portoyne?
Yeah, I am content to talk about Ken. I've never written it down, although one day I suppose I ought to before it all gets forgotten. And there's a little bit of background. Ken was a youth hostel warden. He was 31, I think, when he was on station. He had wanted to be a member of Civivian's TAE, but hadn't been successful. And so he came down to the Antarctic as a cook. He seemed to have disaster follow him around because he was on Deception Island when it erupted the first time and had to be evacuated. Anyway, he arrived at Argentine Islands and we settled down for the winter. But there's another little bit of background you have to know, and that was that in those days, Bass didn't recruit doctors for every station. Mm. And their policy seemed to be they'd have a doctor at Cygni and a doctor at Halley, and they'd have one on the Antarctic Peninsula somewhere, and the plane would winter at Deception Island, and if necessary, would be flown to wherever it needed to go. Sadly, they bent the plane, didn't they? And the pilot and one or two others ended up doing an enforced winter at Fossil Bluff. So there was no plane. So the winter commences, and I found Ken one of the more difficult characters to deal with on the station, particularly because he was the oldest and I was nearly the youngest, and perhaps, I don't know, well, subsequently it did come to light that he thought he should be base commander, but I don't think we ever knew Ken in his natural personality because of the nature of the illness he had.
Which was?
It was ulcerative colitis. So, anyway, the winter progressed and I got a feeling that there was somebody ill on the station. The reason I got that feeling was really rather direct, and that was that we had one chemical toilet which had to be emptied every day. And I started noticing blood in the toilet. And so I had to try and identify who I think it was. And I narrowed it down to two people. I approached the wrong one. but he was a pretty good, solid sort of chap, and I then knew that it was Ken. So I approached Ken, and he, what he said was, "Yeah, I think I might have a bit of piles." And so I got on the radio to Mike Holmes, who was at Stonington, and said, "You know, got this problem." And he said, "Oh, you'll have to carry out a rectal inspection." So that's what I did. You know. amazing the things you do, you know, particularly for me, who never had any sort of medical training whatsoever, and very little training of any sort, of course, in those days. You were expected to find your own way. So I carried out this rectal inspection, and needless to say, there weren't any piles. And we sort of let things tick on a little bit.
Did Ken resist this? Because
Didn't resist that inspection.
You were going to rumble him, weren't you?
Yeah, but he didn't. But he still said, "Well, you know, it's nothing serious."
Okay, but he knew, of course, what he was, didn't he?
Oh, he knew what it was. Yes. At least I'm pretty sure he did, because he'd had previous bouts of it. So, approaching midwinter, a couple of days before midwinter, he's clearly not well, and things aren't going well in the kitchen. And so I decide that I have to step in, and I basically order him to bed and say, "Look, you've got to go to bed, Ken, and we'll take it from there." And, of course, once we get him in bed, we realise just how serious things are. We find out that he's lost something like 50 or 60 pounds in weight, because we used to have this little game on base of the Diddy Men and the Giants. You know, we'd plot our weight each week, and there'd be the fatties and the little thin guys. Down there, I was one of the little thin guys, you know, 10 stone weakling with a concave chest sort of thing. Once we got him in bed, we found he had lost a huge amount of weight. And more distressing was the number of times he had to go to the loo, and what he was passing, and the fact that, you know, he was... Well, I was worried he was going to die on me, and was starting to wonder what to do with the corpse, really. So once we got him in bed, we could start taking measurements on him, really, and start talking to Doc Holmes about that. And Doc Holmes started talking back to England, and started to be apparent that it might be something a bit more serious. And I think I don't know whether it was Doc Holmes who actually recognised it first. I think it probably was, that it was probably ulcerative colitis. And so we then got engaged with a specialist in England, a guy called Professor Gallagher, I think, who was at the University of Leeds, who was the world expert in ulcerative colitis at that point. And from there, we had to start trying to come up with a treatment regime for him, because, of course, we didn't have any of the right drugs or anything on station. Didn't even have enough toilet paper. That became another little crisis, actually. And I was having to teach myself how to give this guy intramuscular injections. In fact, I was reading something today in a base diary, which has a comment that John was having to give injections with the needle as you could roll marbles down. You know, bloody horrible things. Anyway, so I was giving him various drugs by injection to try and stop him being sick, as far as I remember. But it was clear that something had to be organised if he was going to survive. Now, I don't know the ins and outs of exactly what went on between the Foreign Office and the Argentine government. But I did learn subsequently it was the president of Argentina that authorised this airdrop of drugs that we got.
What time of year are we talking about now?
Middle of winter.
Right.
In fact, the airdrop of drugs took place in mid-July. And that in itself was one hell of an operation. Don't know whether it was the first time it had ever been attempted in Antarctica, but it must be pretty well the first. And an Argentine Navy DC-4 flew from Rio Gallegos down to us. And, of course, we could only provide very, very, very minimum navigation aids for this guy. In fact, we had one good quality HF transmitter, which we could speak to him with, and we had one old standby transmitter, which we couldn't really make to work very well. And so what we did in the end was to use the good one when he was getting close to provide him a non-directional beacon. Because when he took off, very early in the morning from Rio Gallegos, the weather was all right for us. But then it went downhill. And by the time he arrived overhead, it was snowing and manky and horrible. We'd laid out two drop zones, right angles to each other on one of the other, well, on two of the islands, so that there was a place where he could do the drops, depending on which way the wind was blowing. But he arrived overhead and then stooshed around for about an hour until finally, I suppose, he found a sucker hole down which he came. And it's really quite a sight to see this four-engined aeroplane lumbering about. I would have thought, you know, difficult to tell, but only 100, 200 feet up. Flew down the drop zone. His first drop, which was with a parachute to slow it. It was really a ranging drop, which came with fruit and vegetables, magazines and all sorts of good things like that. And then three passes, free dropping without parachutes, the packages that that he had brought. And then quick chat to him on the radio, you know, usual things, thanking him, all that sort of stuff. His name was Irigoyen, I think. It was a naval flight. And then he headed off home. And subsequently, he was invited to London the following year and given some sort of award by the Foreign Office for the whole event. But anyway, we got these drugs. Another interesting sideline to that story, of course, it was such a major thing for them that they put one of their warships into Drake's Passage to act as a beacon, I suppose, and also as a rescue facility. That was the Belgrano.
Oh, really?
Yes, really.
Did you retrieve all the packages?
Yes, we did. Everything we retrieved. It gave us a lot of the what were then the specialist drugs for this disease, and also some, I've forgotten what it was called now, but it was a nasty brown sludge that I had to inject in him, which was to combat anemia, because he was, yes, so it was an iron supplement, I suppose. He was becoming very anemic.
As an aside, I have to ask you about the secondary use of a parachute, apparently.
Oh, the secondary use of the parachute. Yeah, well, that became a ski oaring device, and people would like to go rushing off on the sea ice being towed behind that. Particularly, I think it was Brav, the diesel mechanic, that really liked to get out with the parachute.
Did these drugs help?
Yes, they did. They helped really quite significantly. He was on a downhill slope to death, I think, before we got the drugs that we did get. And he bucked up a bit. But he was having 30 or 40 motions a day. We were having to describe the contents of it in detail. And it included old blood, but it also included bits of his insides. It wasn't nice at all. It wasn't a pleasant thing to have to go on the radio and describe all this stuff.
When you say we, do you mean the base commander?
Well, the way I set it up was I had a small team of people nursing. We set up a 24-hour nursing team, and I was one of them. But I did all the contacts with Mike Holmes. So I did all the radio contact and passing of information and so on. So, yeah, I suppose it was me in that regard. Mm. But I had absolutely overwhelming help from Dick Cressman. Dick is a very unusual guy. You'll find that when you meet him. And he at university, he studied electronics and physiology. And he was, in that second year, my sidekick as in the ionospheric department. But Mike Holmes was interested in trying to get some blood pathology on Ken. And we had in the, what we laughingly called the surgery, a grey box which was labelled Royal Naval Transfusion Kit. And in this box, was a bottle of something called Leishman's stain. Now, Dick knew all about that. And we had this book called Samson and Wright, Physiology Book. And he went away and he started to teach himself how to do blood tests. So the next question was to get blood out of Ken, of course. You know, I'd never tried to get blood out of anybody. But anyway, and Ken was, I suppose, very forbearing, really, at this stage, with me poking him with needles and stuff to try and get blood out of him. But we did. We got some sample of blood, and Dick stained up the samples and started doing red blood cell counts. And they were very good. And we sent the results to Mike Holmes, and he was very pleased with them. And he said, well, how about white cell counts? So Dick decided to have a go at those. And he did all this hocus-pocus and gave me all these numbers about the number of granulocytes and leukocytes and God knows what other sites were in Ken's blood. And I did the radio contact with Mike. And I can remember him saying, well, that's very interesting, John. Very interesting. Well done. Of course, he's dead. And that was because we got the stain wrong. But in the end, we were getting the whole thing going. And Dick was running a blood path lab on Ken, which was really quite professional and, you know, working very well.
Do you think, in retrospect, that Ken Portwine knew he was doomed?
Oh, yeah. I don't know whether he knew he was doomed. I wouldn't be able to go as far as to say that. But and his attitude was that he wasn't really ill, that I had panicked, that I was too young to be base commander, that I'd set all this activity in train and couldn't stop it, and that I had one really, really difficult day with him when he was quite hysterical. And I actually physically sat on his chest and said, I'm not going to get off you, Ken, until you stop. He had all sorts of fantasies. I won't go into the details on them. They weren't very pleasant. And, you know, it wasn't Ken. It was the disease has psychological overtones to it as well. And oddly enough, that taught me a very big lesson, because I came out of having been just been sitting on him, feeling really quite stressed, you know, as you would in the situation I was in. And I was handed a telegram by Tony Feenan, the radio operator, which was basically saying in quite peremptory language, why have you ordered the fueling hose? Okay. Now, there's a story to this, because the previous year I'd walked round with one of the logistics people from BAS headquarters, and we'd been discussing how we did the fueling from the ship and the problems we had. And he said, oh, order the new fueling hose all the way back. You know, don't stint yourself, order the whole lot. So I did. And so now he was coming back and asking me why I'd ordered all this fueling hose. And so I lost my rag. And I sent a message back basically saying, if people come down here in the summer and don't take any notice of what's said to them, why the bloody hell do they come? And I got an immediate message back from Sir Vivian Fuchs, basically reprimanded me, so I resigned.
On base?
Yes. I resigned on base, there and then. But my resignation telegram was intercepted in the Falkland Islands by Clem Clements and... the name's gone out of my mind at the moment. It'll come again in a minute. Ted Clapp. And very quickly they're calling me on voice from Stanley, basically to say, don't do it. Mm-hmm. We love you. We know what you're going through. Just tranquilo. And that taught me a lesson. I never did that again. Always, whenever I got angry, I put the message in a drawer and just leave it there. I do it now figuratively with emails. Leave it. Don't send it. So anyway, we continued on. But the next amazing thing in this saga was about the 17th of July, I think, that the airdrop took place. And we'd already been dealing with him since before midwinter, so before the 20th, about the 19th or 20th of June, since we'd had him in bed. When on a grey day, somebody rushes into the base and said, there's an aeroplane overhead. And we go out, and there's this little red beaver flying around the station. And before we can get hold of it on the radio or anything, it's landed on one of the adjacent islands, on Skua Island. So I set off across the fast ice up Stella Creek to meet these people. And four people come in the other way, and they turn out to be from the Argentine Air Force, a Capitan Luján, Lieutenant Pose, Dr. Itrieta, and a flight engineer whose name escapes at the moment. We call him Oscar, I think. And they had come to take Ken away, they said. And we had some problems with language, although subsequently Brian Gardner was our sort of interpreter, because he seemed to be able to speak a bit of Spanish. My view was, well, where can you take him that's of any use? Because they'd come from Matienzo, the Argentine station over the other side of the Antarctic Peninsula. So I said, well, stay. You know, the doctor will be really, really valuable. It turned out that he was a hematology consultant. And so what he did, from what I could see, was he took one look at that nursing regime and just said, I'll leave that alone, that's working fine. And he concentrated on giving Ken blood transfusions. But anyway, I agreed that they should stay on the station. I couldn't see what they could do that was of any use, which we couldn't do, because they could only fly them as far as their station, and that didn't seem to me to be a very sensible thing to do. And then it gets a bit murky, and I'm not quite sure whether there was any formal contact between the British Foreign Office and the Argentine government as to what happened subsequently. It all seemed to me as though it was hand to mouth, and it was really being left to me to organise and make decisions, because I learned through Capitan Luján that the plan was that they were going to get their icebreaker San Martin out of dry dock and sail her down, and that they wanted to try and fly Ken up to Esperanza, which is right on the northern tip of the Antarctic Peninsula, and to make it easy for the icebreaker to pick him up. And when I asked Sir Vivian by radio what was going on, he basically said, I don't know, you know, play it by ear. And so that's what I did, and I agreed that as soon as I knew that the icebreaker had sailed, then the next good day we'd try and fly him, Ken, up to Esperanza. Well, we had quite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing on the radio, because the Argentinians were talking back to Argentina, and they were phone-patching through to various things, something which, of course, we knew very little about because we weren't allowed to do it. And one day I was talking to what I thought was Luján's superior, thanking him for what they were doing, and found I was being broadcast on Radio Mundo, I think it was called, in Argentina. Anyway, it was Radio Mundo that subsequently allowed me to hear that the icebreaker had sailed. And so now we'll fly the aeroplane with Ken. Now, Ken had this curious dependence on me, but also this curious, you know, psychological problem. But when it came to it, he decided that he wouldn't go unless I went with him, which is why I was on the aeroplane. So we waited for good weather, and come the morning of the 9th of August, the forecast from Esperanza was for a break in the weather, a clear period, followed by poor weather. Well, we woke up on that morning with freezing fog. Looking upwards, beautiful blue sky. Looking that way, nothing. And we had the aeroplane parked on some sea ice. We'd marked out a runway on some sea ice in front of the station. And we had about a 350-yard runway marked out. And at the end of that sea ice, which was between 10 and 20 centimetres thick, there was broken water, and, you know, broken ice and open water and stuff. So We get Ken on the plane, lying down in the back of the aircraft. And myself and the doctor are just sitting on sleeping bags and things in the back of the aeroplane, nowhere to strap in. And we leave the flight engineer behind. The plan is that they'll take Ken, drop him off, and then they'll bring me home at some subsequent point. So, now, by this time I'd been in the Antarctic for, 18 months or more. So I suppose, in a sense, I was a professional. I knew what the environment was like and how it could bite you. I didn't know much about aviation. In fact, absolutely nothing, really. But I agreed with the pilot when he said there's no problems with the weather. We can get airborne. There's no hazards on the runway. We'll be fine. So I accepted that that was the case. He was an experienced captain in the Argentine Air Force. So we head off in the mist down the runway. And what I now know subsequently to be very likely occurrence happened. The aircraft iced up, the wings iced up, the carburetor iced up, and they were then in a basically engine failure on takeoff situation. Again, I now know, because as a result of all this, decided to learn to fly. I now know that if you have engine failure on takeoff, the one thing that's drummed into you over and over again is do not attempt to turn round. Do not attempt to turn back. Land straight ahead. That's all you can do. Because if you try and make a turn, you'll lose too much height in the turn. And of course, they couldn't, because directly ahead of us was water at -2 and ice blocks and stuff like that. If we'd gone into that, we'd have had it. So they did bank. I didn't know what was going on, apart from the fact that the aeroplane obviously wasn't flying very well. And we were being thrown around, and we banked. And then looking forward, I saw the pilot and the co-pilot say something in Spanish, obviously very, very alarmed to each other. And then there was a very sharp jolt. And then a few more jolts as we banged and crashed about the place. And I can remember thinking to myself, the next time I hit that bulkhead is going to be it. There's no way out of this for us. Curious sort of thought, just rather disappointed, actually. But then the aeroplane suddenly came to rest. The door next to me burst open. And I looked out and I saw what I thought was either an ice floe or an iceberg. And the next thing I remember, I was standing on it looking back at the aeroplane.
The aeroplane was in water.
Yeah, well, it turned out that once I got onto the ice, I realised that what had happened was the aeroplane had come to rest in what's known as the tide crack between the land ice and the sea ice against a little island and was just slowly sinking in the tide crack. So I was out of the aeroplane, wet up to the knees. And I then told the doctor to start passing emergency equipment out. Amazingly, this thing didn't blow up, And then we had to get Ken out of the aeroplane. And so the co-pilot, who had been given the honour of flying the Mercy mission, Lieutenant Posey, he formed a human bridge from the door of the aeroplane to the land ice, with me standing in the water at the edge of the shore, holding his feet, and we walked Ken across his back, got him into a sleeping bag, and then Posey stripped off down to his underwear to start trying to get himself dry and get dry clothing on, but was also getting really quite upset. He was quite emotional about the fact that the aeroplane had crashed and it all being his fault. And now, by now, I was sitting on an ice block taking photographs, as you do. We've got a little fire burning so that there was some smoke to tell people where we were.
You were some distance from base, were you?
We were about a mile and a half, 2 miles. It's on a little island called the Three Little Pigs. And the Han was still in the aeroplane, sloshing about. And I looked down at him and I said to him, hey, Le Han, you know, you should come and do something about Pose. He's not very happy. And he's a funny little guy, old Le Han. He was almost as broad as he was high. He was a squat little chap. And he looked up at me and he said, oh, it's no problem, he says, no problem. It's only his third crash, it's my seventh crash, it's no problem. You know? and then he stomped off somewhere up the island to see where we were, I think. And my boots were freezing up, so I got Pose to help me pull them off and got Ken out of his sleeping bag, took his boots off him and put him back in again, so I'd got some boots to keep my feet dry. And then the base members turned up with the sledge. They had realised something had gone wrong. I think Le Han had managed to tell them that we had ditched, I think that's what he said, which made them dig out a boat rather quickly, although they didn't bring it with them, and that we were all right. Anyway, they turned up, and we took Ken back to the station, by which time it's a lovely sunny day. And, of course, for me, there wasn't any time for me to stop and think to myself, I've just been in an air crash, you know, because I had to make certain that Ken was all right. I had to make certain that everybody was told what had happened and made certain that next of kin were told quickly so that there wasn't any news get to them which was inaccurate and so on and so forth and so forth. And so I never had time to stop and think about it. And that had consequences because some years later, I found I'd got a pathological fear of flying. And the way I solved that was to go and learn to fly, which did. Did solve it. But anyway, so we'd got Ken back to the station. And then, basically, what happened was we waited till the icebreaker got close enough. And then it flew its helicopters in. It was in late August. To take him out, by which time he was really quite psychologically disturbed. Don't really want to go into the details of that, but suffice to say that a remarkable thing happened once we knew he had landed on the ship. And that was, first of all, we had a ceremonial final emptying of his bedpan, with Brian Gardner playing his recorder. So we ceremonially emptied it into the tide crack. But also, the base members, without me saying anything, just took all sign of him out of the bunk room. Because, of course, it was a shared bunk room, so you know others had had to sleep in there. Just erased any presence of him. And I remember somebody noted in the base diary for that day that never had the morale on the station been higher than it was that night. I mean, I felt as though I was floating around 2 foot above the ground because of the relief that I felt from it all finally being over.
Do you recall any sense of resentment that this man had put you all in this difficult situation?
No. No, and I was extremely lucky. There's two things that can happen in a situation like that. Either the group pulls together or it fragments when faced with a crisis. For whatever reason, my team pulled together. I couldn't have wanted for a better team of people. Mm-hmm. No doubt about that. Whether that was my leadership or whether it was just their natural abilities and survival instincts, I don't know. But I didn't have any problems with getting things done that I needed doing.
But you didn't feel personally let down that he hadn't told you, or he hadn't told Bass that he was poorly?
I don't recall that, because to start with, of course, in the winter, we didn't know that. We didn't know that he had had that disease beforehand. That became apparent afterwards, that he'd had it and known he'd got it. So, no, I think I found it hard to deal with him, as you would do if you were dealing with a psychotic. And it's very interesting. Again, Mike Holmes, the doctor at Stonington, was very good at recognising things like that. And so, you know, I'd have this nightly schedule with him where I'd pass over all the physiologic information and so on about how Ken was, and we'd talk about treatment and so on. But he would occasionally say to me, look, just clear the Radio Shack. Tell everybody to go out. And then he'd just talk to me. And really what he was trying to do was to keep my confidence up. And one of the most important things he said to me was, look, he's neurotic. And neurotic people seem perfectly sound. It makes you think that you're the one that's in the wrong. You are not. And just remember that, that you're dealing with somebody who is not in his right mind.
So how do you rate the support that Mike Holmes gave you?
Oh, I couldn't rate it higher, really. I mean, he was just right, really, I think. You know, he kept me on an even keel, because it was a real strain, stress for weeks on end. Not only just having the responsibility of somebody who could die on you, but all these other things that were going on, and making certain that they went on in a sensible way. But even so, there was humour in it. One day, we used to keep this nursing diary, which sadly, when we sent Ken off, we sent with him, because I'd love to see it again. It has some beautiful comments in it. There was one in there which said, Ken says he's feeling better this morning. He must have done, because he's done a real turd. and things like that, you know. But
what was it? How did the guys react when the news came through that he had, in fact, passed away? Did it matter by that point, or had you
It's very on? Interesting you ask that, because in those circumstances you get quite a harsh outlook on life. And although we mourned his passing, we didn't really. You know, we sent some kind words to his mother and sent flowers and stuff. But I, oddly enough, I remember in wording that message, I debated between using the word died and passed away. And I used the word died, which I think sums up the way we thought. But there again, you see, there's some interesting sidelines to that story, was that it had been agreed, as far as I understood it, that... I think it was British United Airlines that flew to South America at that time, that Bassett got it all organised, that as soon as he got to Buenos Aires, he would be air repatriated back to England via British United Airlines and go straight to this Leeds hospital where this Gallagher guy was going to treat him. But he got as far as Buenos Aires, and they carried out the procedure, which is the only procedure then and probably still is now, called an ileostomy, which is removes all your insides and you crap into a bag. And he died of peritonitis. So whether they would have saved him or not, I don't know, because I heard subsequently that his guts had perforated quite a bit, actually. And yeah, we'd seen the evidence of it in his bedpan during the time. But we had some we had some fun. I mean, this guy Posey, who was the young... I bet he was a fighter pilot in the Falklands War, because he was that sort of character. But he knew how to marshal helicopters, he said. So I thought, all right, well, you can marshal the helicopter from San Martin when it comes in. And so a helicopter comes in. And Jose is there doing all the right signs to marshal this helicopter and walking backwards as he does it. And then, of course, as the helicopter gets close to the ground, big spray of snow comes up and Jose disappears. And when it settles, he's not there anymore. He's gone. And we walk over and look over the ice cliff. And he falls. And I expect Brian told me that story. Yeah, falling over backwards into the... luckily, he'd only fallen 10 feet or something into a snowdrift. But, you know...
let's take a break, John.